Thank you, Perry. 6 minutes now past 12 o'clock. And good afternoon. Welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Ankton. Well, cleanup continues in southern Minnesota today. It's been a week now since those tornadoes rolled through southern Minnesota, but it's certainly going to be months at least before life returns to some semblance of normalcy in St. Peter and Comfrey and LeCenter and all the areas in between. Today, as you heard, some of the victims of the storm testified before the Minnesota House Ways and Means Committee urging passage of a $27 million tornado relief package, and that bill is receiving immediate attention. It could pass the full legislature yet today. So apparently, money is on the way. Yesterday, the mayor who led Grand Forks through last year's flooding offered sympathy and encouragement to the tornado victims in St. Peter. This hour, we're going to hear from Grand Forks Mayor Pat Owens. We'll also be reporting on the rebuilding underway in Comfrey. And then later in this hour, we'll continue our coverage of the 30th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his legacy. First, though, recovering from the tornado. Here is Grand Forks Mayor Pat Owens speaking to St. Peter residents who gathered yesterday at St. Peter's First Lutheran Church.
I saw your community on TV a week ago, and during our flood, I just couldn't cry. There was so much to do, I could not cry, and I'm one who gets emotional at times. But when I saw your city on TV last week, I cried. And I cried for the two lives that were lost, and also for what I knew that you would have to go through. And that's why I called on Wednesday and asked if we could send up volunteers or if there was anything we could do or if I could come and just tell you that you'll make it through. And I'm going to tell you a little bit of what I've been through and how you can relate to that. Almost a year ago to the date, I guess it was April 18th, we had the worst disaster per capita in the nation. We had our fire, which burned 11 of our downtown buildings, and our flood. It was the largest evacuation of a city since the Civil War. We evacuated 52,000 people. The one thing that I couldn't believe today as I flew over coming here was that with the devastation that you've had, you didn't lose more lives. And so I honestly believe you have very, very much to be thankful for. In our city, I thank God every day. And how I began to go along was we thought we were better prepared for that flood than ever before, and we did not know the magnitude of water we were going to have. And it is just common to what you have been through, although yours hit immediately. I think it was about the 14th or 15th of April, we got our people along the river together, about 1,000 people, and asked them to voluntarily evacuate because we didn't know what our river would do if it went over 49 feet, and we were getting very worried. On the evening of April 17th, we had been working really hard in the community for several weeks. I mean, we had to fill 3.5 million sandbags. And we had the greatest response from across all over. People came to help us, and it was just unbelievable. And on April 17th, that evening, I went home about 9:30 and 1:20 in the morning, and I'll never forget that because my clock is lit near my bed. And the phone rang and they said, you need to get back to the disaster center immediately. And I knew exactly what was happening. Our city was going under. And then when I got back there, I saw a very frustrated group of city, county employees, our emergency manager, and many people bent over the maps at the table. They couldn't do a thing. All our resources were underwater. All the play was underwater. We couldn't build secondary lines of defense, and we had a city of 52,000 people, and it was just overwhelming. About an hour later, they asked me, because the mayor is the only one that can evacuate a city, they asked me, you know, do you think we should evacuate a city? Well, at that point, we pulled everybody off the dikes because they were in extreme danger. We're very fortunate we didn't lose lives. But I'll tell you, when it came to evacuating that city, all I could think of was, you know, if I'm wrong, they're going to impeach me. If I'm right, you know, we've got to do this. And I thought, I didn't think of me. I thought, go ahead, but I'm going to err on the side of being safe. And honestly, I can tell you, I think God took over at that time, because the decisions that we made from that point on were unbelievable. And I look back and I don't even believe that they were made by myself and my staff and my counsel. So we started at 4:15 in the morning, blowing sirens, sending police and fire down into a neighborhood that has a dike that was built in the 50s. And as the people were leaving their homes, they said they could hear the water coming over the dike, and they could hear the shattering of their patio doors. And in that area, only the roofs were showing, and many of them, it just spattered the houses apart. So your city looks pretty much like that area in many of the places that I've seen. And then we made sure we went to the other area of town in an orderly fashion, so we would have no mass confusion as people left town. We had people in 49 of the 50 states. People across the country were just absolutely, I can't tell you how thankful we are for what they did for us. From that point on, our emergency center went underwater. It was in the basement of the police department. We had to move that within an hour's time. I asked to go on, and I am a small country mayor too. I said I'm very quiet, but I asked to go on TV because people had to know that they were in danger. And so I went on TV and just stressed saving lives. You know, don't turn around, just get out. Many of the people had left their animals in their homes. So after the dire emergency was over, about 3-4 days later of evacuating people, the animals were left, and so we had to get some help to get the animals out. And I remember going to the school at the Grand Forks Air Force Base, where they were keeping many of the elderly and disabled, and two elderly women came up to me and were just crying and handed me their keys and said, "Mayor, please go get our cat out of the house." And so I thought, well, I took the keys and I thought, well, somehow I'll get that cat. And I turned around and I started walking away, and about 10 steps away was a gentleman from the National Humane Society. And so God put him in the right spot too. They rescued, I believe, almost every animal. I don't think they lost any, in fact. So, but that was for the emotional stability of the people. From that point on, it was just news media. For a person who hadn't been too upfront, it was overwhelming. I had the National Guard was there. FEMA, our Red Cross, Salvation Army, all these various agencies working together, and we moved our emergency center up to the University of North Dakota Operations Center and operated out of there. And on we had to lobby in Washington, D.C., but the greatest fear that I had was the emotional stability of our people. For the first part of a disaster, you're in shock, the adrenaline's working, and you're helping one another. But as time goes on, you get just very tired and very frustrated at seeing the devastation within your community, and that does set in. And our people right now are just physically, emotionally, a lot of them financially drained, so it's just continuous to try and tell them they will be okay. And that's what I tried to do during the flood, is be sure to tell them. And the only way that we survived was by faith in God. And there were days I would wake up, and I still do that, and I just say, God, help me get through this day. And it seems like it works, and he is looking after us, and I know he will look after you also. You have a long road to go. It'll take you 1 year to 5 years. You'll go through frustration. You'll go through anger. You'll go through hurt. You'll go through blame. And don't be afraid to tell another person when you're hurting. Don't be afraid to go get help. We had a couple suicides, and I had many people come to me that were suicidal, and we got them help through disaster outreach. And it was just sad that one of our custodians in one of the schools just couldn't take it. The school was devastated, and so he took his own life. And we had known he was hurting, but we had no way to know, we could have helped him, but it was just too much for him to bear. People go through frustration because they've lost their employment. 90% of our businesses were down. We had no businesses. We lost totally over 1,000 homes that need to be torn down, and about 50 to 60% of the city, even higher than that, had water damage. 90% of our city was underwater at one time. And we are a city of 52,000 people. And it was just overwhelming to go over that city and see your city in water. I know one gentleman told me as I was walking along, he said, you know, you've become a mayor without a city. And I thought about that. And you know what? A city is not the buildings. A city is the people within that community and how they get work together. And it's the faith and spirit in those people. And you're going to have to work hard to make yourself, pull yourselves up by your bootstraps. Federal and state government came through very, very well, but our damage was about $1.3 to $1.5 billion. So we have a long way to go, and the 11 buildings burned downtown, so we're in the process of cleaning up, and it has been a real challenge. But the only thing that has kept me going is people and my faith in God. And one of the greatest things is all the churches came together. When I was running for mayor after 33 years as assistant, many of the ministers and priests would come up to me and say, you know, we're praying for you to win. And I would tease them. And I'd say, well, hold it. I may need it someday. After the flood, I told them, I'm cashing in. I need it. And I believe that's what carried our community through, is it became just helping one another. We were all the same. When the president came to our community, he went over the city, and I met with him for about 20 minutes in a room, and he cried too. It was that bad, and I could tell he was sincere. About 10 minutes before we were supposed to go in to have a session with our people, and our people, we had about 10,000 of our citizens at the airbase just on cots, elderly and so forth. It was just devastating to see that, and not knowing, you know, what their homes would be like. And many just left with the clothes on their back and had nothing else. But when the president came, I was thinking we were out of our home too, and we had left. My husband and son had packed me a suitcase, and I had left with very little clothes. So I thought, gosh, what am I going to wear? And I was having a bad hair day, just like today. And so when I sat down, about 10 minutes before we went in to sit down, someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, Mayor, you're going to give the opening speech with the president. And I thought, my gosh, you know, I hadn't slept in about a week and a half, 2 weeks, and you're supposed to be, you know, I was trying to make sure everything was okay and things were running right. And I'll tell you, my staff was absolutely super. I can't tell you how we worked together. It was just like one staff between county and city and state and federal. It was just super. But as I sat down with the president, I started to say, well, this morning when I woke up, you know, I didn't know what to wear because we were displaced too. And I had one pair of jeans and a mismatched blue outfit, and my husband had packed me two silk pantsuits, which you don't wear on a dike. And I was looking at all these people that were hurting, and it was very easy to talk because all I could think of was, you know, it doesn't matter what you wear, we're all in this together. And it's the faith and spirit that are in these people. It's not the buildings that are important right now, it's the people. And before I got through, I didn't know what to wear. The president touched me on the arm and said, you look fine, and everybody laughed, and I lost my chain of thought, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is gonna be a disaster. But I'll tell you, the president coming did bring hope. And I know you, in your community, it's a smaller community, but I know you need to work with your public officials to make things happen. You work with your congressional delegation to make sure that you get your HUD and FEMA monies that you should get. And I know we are a direct state to get the housing and urban development monies from James Lee Witts, or it's from Secretary Cuomo, Department of Housing. But you go through your state and work really close with your congressional people, and I'm sure that you'll get the aid that you need also. That office has just been fantastic to us. It has given us a jump start. One thing we need to keep reminding our community is that government isn't going to bring you all the way back. There are things you need to do for yourself, but it will jump start you, and that's what it's done to our community. We've come a long way. Another thing right now our community is in the anger stage. We're trying to spend the monies to rebuild our community. We have 14 council people and a mayor, And of course, I don't vote, but we're trying to spend them as responsibly as we can, and you only have 3 years to make sure things are on board. So we built some homes to temporarily house. They're good homes that people who have lost their homes can move into, and it's to jumpstart because the private industry couldn't. So there was debate in there, and we don't want to get into the private industry, but we had to do that to keep our citizens. And I know another thing that I did right at the beginning of the flood was appointed what I call my tri-chairs, and it was three of our main city department heads, our city engineer, our community development director, and our finance director. And those three people have worked with myself and city council and totally organized that flood response. And so that disaster was made a lot lighter by the responsibility put on certain people to carry it through. And it was their responsibility to delegate and get it done. Also, there is a lot of doubt when you have disaster like this toward your city and county officials and so forth. And I really want to persuade you to trust those people, because it's very hard decisions at time. Give your input, but trust and work with them when there is a decision made. There is nothing worse than having a community that is split. And I also formed a business redevelopment committee, which consisted of 10 of our business people who worked as a mayor's committee and worked with the mayor to get our businesses back online. And that worked beautifully also. We now have 90% of our businesses online. But you've got to stick together, and you've got to work with your city and county people, and you've got to listen to your mayor, because it's a tough, tough job to bring people out of a disaster, and the only way you can do it is by working together. And I guess what I stress to you today is you will make it. You've come a long way in a week. You will, like I said, you'll get tired, you'll feel frustrated, but just put it in. Anytime I can't figure something out, I put it in God's hands, and believe me, you get through it. And that is the only thing that has helped myself and my community come through, is just to have a lot of faith, which you have to have just overwhelming faith to get through these, and care for one another. There can be no selfishness in this, because there are programs put in place at times that are very hard to be fair, and I think at this point you have to just. Sometimes they're not quite equal, but you have to do the very best you can to distribute those programs among the people and treat them equally. But it's just hard, because there is no way for them to be totally fair. And so you just have to do the best you can and move forward. And I guess the one thought I leave you with today is you have the heart and soul of the whole nation with you as you go through this, including our city. And you are in our prayers constantly, and I know you are in the prayers of many people. And I think it was Comfrey also was really devastated. And you can rebuild. And as I said, you will be better. Our city is coming back, and a year later, I would give anything if we hadn't had the flood. But things are coming back, and they are coming back much better. And people are starting to see it. And you can see that people are planting flowers and different things. And so you can do it, but you've got to just make yourself take rest. I have to keep telling myself that too. You've got to rest and so forth, because if you become overtired, it becomes overwhelming to you. And anything we can do to help, I was going to visit with your mayor, and I know what he's going through, because I've been through it too, and it's very devastating to a person who is the leader of the city to see their city in the condition it's in today. But it will get better. And help one another, and you will come through it. That's all I can tell you. It looks overwhelming at this point, but you will come through it, and you will be bigger, better, stronger, because you see things along the way you wouldn't have done otherwise. And my favorite motto, I guess, is keep the faith. That sometime will be the only thing that will carry you through a day. But don't ever give up. And it'll take you probably, I'd say, about 5 years to come through this. And we have probably about 10 years to get through ours. But never feel sorry for yourself. Just, you can't feel sorry for yourself or you won't recover. You've got to just say, this is the way it is, and this is what we have to do, and you have to move on. And life is too short to continually dwell on it, and it will destroy you if you dwell on it. So just team together, do the best you can, and when I come back to this city in about a year, I know that you will have done an excellent job of recovering. I see what you've done in 1 week, and I can't believe it. And I don't know if you have volunteers in here, but I'll tell you, they are godsend when you have a disaster like this. They just come in droves. I was teasing our Red Cross and our Salvation Army because we had no water. Our water plant was down for almost 3 weeks, so we had no drinking water, no sewage system. I mean, we went back to primitive, and we were called the porta potty of the capital porta potty of the nation, I guess. But that was the worst you could ever do, is to be without water. You had no showers, you had no water to cook, you had canned water, and. But I was telling the Salvation Army and the Red Cross, they were our godsend. I said, I love to eat out, but I said one of the things I never realized was eating out would be chasing a Red Cross or Salvation Army truck down the street. But I did it, and they fed us for probably 4 to 6 weeks and have still got their presence in our community. They'd go up and down the streets for many, many months after that. We couldn't have done without them. And I guess just be patient, and you will come out of this, and keep the faith.
Grand Forks Mayor Pat Owens speaking yesterday at the First Lutheran Church in St. Peter, Minnesota. Residents of Comfrey, Minnesota began their second week of recovery from the tornado with a church service. Most of the town packed into St. Paul's Catholic Church yesterday. That's the only church still usable in the community of about 500 people. Main Street Radio's Mark Stile reports.
The tornado wrenched off steeples, broke stained glass windows, and tore up roofs at Comfrey's four churches. St. Paul's on the north side of town suffered the least, but even it will likely need new shingles. Under bright sunshine, many Comfrey residents walked to church Sunday, past the wreckage of their former lives. In a town where it's hard to take anything for granted, there was one familiar sound.
Last Sunday, 1 week ago today, the tempest arrived suddenly, with scarcely any warning. 45 seconds after the siren switch was pulled, the twister roared into this town.
Lutheran minister Lawrence Woolrobby of Redwood Falls delivered the sermon, joining Comfrey ministers and priests and church officials in the multi-denominational service. Members of the Lutheran churches in town and the United Church of Christ joined with Catholics at St. Paul's Church. Woolrobby told the churchgoers it's okay if they wonder why God allowed the tornado to happen.
The reason I know that God will not clobber you for asking such questions of Him is that this God of ours is not above the storm. This God of ours is not somehow aloof from or exempt from the gale force winds that sometimes sweep through our lives. God, our God, is with us in the eye of the storm.
When the darkness appears, oh, and the night draws near, and the day is past and gone, hear my cry, hear my call. Take hold my hand, lest I fall. Oh, precious Lord, take my hand and lead me home.
The intense emotion was broken several times by laughter and clapping. The loudest applause at the service was reserved for Comfrey's mayor. Linda Wallin directs the town's rebuilding effort, holding dozens of meetings with town residents, the Red Cross, Salvation Army, FEMA, the Minnesota Emergency Management Division, and others. She has an unusual electoral background. Wallin won the mayor's chair by the slimmest of margins. When the votes were counted, she and her opponent were tied.
Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine that a flip of a coin would bring me to the greatest challenge of my life. The challenge to work with a caring and wonderful community of people and to rebuild a town. I ask each and every one of you to have perseverance, to be patient, and to be strong in our vision of rebuilding Comfrey.
That vision seems to be off to a good start. Much of the debris has been hauled away, more is piled along curbs awaiting pickup. That activity, though, came to a halt Sunday morning to give everyone a chance to be in church. Even after the service, just about the loudest sound in town was a wind-blown piece of tin roof slamming over and over into the building's rafters. Lynn Schmidt is walking nearby with her granddaughter Courtney perched on her shoulders. Compared to what the town was like right after the tornado, she likes what she sees.
You couldn't walk through the streets. You had to watch every step you took. It was water all over, and now coming, at least you can walk up and down the streets. I mean, people are getting their yards cleaned up and stuff, and we look pretty good.
Perhaps most important, Comfrey residents have kept their humor. One homeowner tacked up a large poster near a punched-out picture window. It shows a frazzled cat with the caption, "A Bad Hair Day." Another has painted this announcement on the side of a badly damaged house, "For Sale, Cheap." That sense of humor will be tested in the coming weeks. At the church service, one minister warned the adrenaline surge of experiencing a tornado is often overwhelmed by the detail of rebuilding. Ahead are decisions and paperwork as the town turns a vision into reality. This is Mark Style, Main Street Radio.
27 minutes now before 1 o'clock, and this is Midday, coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. Of course, much, much more on tornado recovery efforts coming up on All Things Considered later this afternoon. Saturday marked the 30th anniversary of the shooting in Memphis, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Of course, events were held around the nation to mark the anniversary and to remember Dr. King. This year also marks the 25th anniversary of the death of the great Jewish leader, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who spent so many years working with Dr. King. And next on Midday, we're going to focus on King, Heschel, and their legacy. Dr. Vincent Harding is a professor of religion and social transformation at the University of Denver. Back in the 60s, he worked with Martin Luther King and the Freedom Movement. In 1968, he was named director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Center. He's worked on two major television series, Eyes on the Prize and the Black Heritage series. He's also written several books, including There is a River and Martin Luther King Jr., The Inconvenient Hero. Recently at the City Club Forum of Cleveland, Vincent Harding looked back on those heady days of the civil rights movement and how they translate to the 1990s. Here's Dr. Vincent Harding.
I am very grateful for the opportunity to be a part of this soapbox, this gathering together in some of the best traditions of democracy and humanity. I'm very glad because I am deeply convinced that we need constantly, continuously, compassionately to explore together who we are, what we're for, and who are the foundational people of our society. I'm glad to be here too because I agree deeply with that ambiguous and brilliant European scholar Hannah Arendt, who said at one point, "It is when we are in dialogue that we are most human." I intend to be human. I'm encouraging you to be human. Unless we can talk, unless we can listen, unless we can look into each other's faces and not just on screens in our living rooms, unless we can engage each other, not only do we miss our humanity, but we betray our democracy. And our democracy, unless it is constantly built, loses life, loses strength. I am with you now to build that life. It is fascinating that we come to this time at the point where many of us are preparing for the Passover season. For that is a time when we are called upon as a divine action to remember where we came from. That's part of what makes us human. Part of remembering the fact that unless we know where we came from, we have no idea where it is that we should be going. So it's fitting that today we should be gathered together around the memory of two extraordinary Americans, one whose forebears were brought here as captives in slavery, and one who escaped from a world set on fire by the practitioners of racial democracy, racial supremacy, rather. Heschel, King met each other 35 years ago in the heart of the struggle to break the power of legal segregation that was one form of America's white supremacy. They met first at a conference on religion and race in 1963 that I happened to attend as well when I was much, much, much younger. And then they gathered together at the March on Washington. Notice this progression. They gathered together for a conference, but the next time they gathered together was not another conference and then a series of conferences on religion and race. They gathered together for a conference, and it was very clear that conferencing was absolutely wonderful, but not sufficient. And so the next time they gathered was to march, for the March on Washington, for jobs and freedom. And then they gathered for the march that took them from Selma to Montgomery. 33 years ago this month. Can you imagine, is it clear to you that just 33 years ago, in our country, just 33 years ago, women and men were being killed in the struggle for the expansion of democracy? And 35 years ago, children were being blown up in churches. 35 years ago. Some of us in this room were living then. And when anyone tells us nothing has changed, do not believe them. And when anyone tells us, but we have still got a very long way to go, do believe them. Heschel and King were on that way. For at the end of the Selma March, it's important to remember that King spoke to those who had walked for 5 years, for 5 days, and he said to them, not everything is okay now, we can stop and take it easy and tell wonderful stories of how brave we are. No, he said, we must keep going. We must keep going. Where? To achieve a more perfect union. We have to keep going to move on towards achieving the promise of democracy in America. And so they moved. They moved north, Heschel and King, to challenge the institutions that created poverty or condoned poverty or were indifferent to poverty and inequality and racial separation in the North. They had to challenge the financial institutions. They had to challenge religious institutions. They had to challenge educational institutions. In order to keep going, and they kept together, the two men kept going together to challenge the betrayal of American democracy that was going on in a war against the poor in Vietnam, a war with many racial elements, a war that squandered human, moral, and financial resources that were so badly needed in America. So the son of the European Jews and the son of the African ancestors joined together to oppose the war in Vietnam, which at the beginning everybody said was absolutely necessary, absolutely right, and absolutely patriotic. But they opposed it as an act of love for their country. They opposed it as an act of commitment to their God. They refused to go along with a mainstream tide that was being poisoned by racism, materialism, militarism, and fear. And because they refused to go along with the tide, they were attacked, attacked, attacked for disloyalty, attacked for being subversive, attacked for going beyond the proper boundaries of religion. They were attacked by those inside their community and outside their community. But as we remember now, what we realize is that they were actually teaching us, if we are willing to learn. They were teaching us that the highest loyalty that human beings can have is not just to what our country and its leaders tell us to do, but that our highest loyalty, if we are to continue being human beings, has to be to the grandest visions among us of the best possibilities that we in our country could have. That our highest loyalty must be to our sense of the call of a loving God. They were teaching us that the values of the unrestricted market and the values of racial supremacy and the values of violence and the values of security at any cost are the real subversive forces that eat away at the heart of democratic possibilities. They were teaching us that true religion knows no boundaries, especially in its concern for the poor, the beaten up, the rejected. They were teaching us that religion was not meant to be some kind of private, eternal life insurance policy. They were teaching us that true religion was not meant to be some guarantee of sweet inner peace, while the bitter cries of the hungry and the homeless and the jobless ring out all around us. No, they were teaching us that true religion opens our hearts and opens our ears and sometimes brings deep pain to our hearts and our being. They were teaching us that religion erases the boundaries of race, of class, of religion itself. They were teaching us that true religion tells us that we are one. As Bobby Kennedy was saying 3 months before his death, they were saying not just that we are one and let's hold some conferences on our oneness, but they were saying we are one and true religion demands that we act on that oneness, to act and take the consequences. If we really believe we are one. Now, when we remember that that's what Heschel and King were about, something in us wants to call out, where are teachers like Heschel and King today? What I would do is to share one of the great Buddhist sayings about teachers. The Buddhists have this wonderful saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. So the question is not, where are the teachers like Heschel and King, someplace out there today? But the deep question for us, if we are trying to build democracy and build humanity, is, how do we get ready? How do we keep going in the path of Heschel and King, the path of compassionate citizenship? How do we keep going on the path of courageous action to create a more perfect union? How do we keep going on the path of commitment to our common human family, to our oneness? And how do we do it when we have to say to people all around us that included in that one family that we are all members of, included in that family are Cubans, Iraqis, Palestinians, and Israelis, as well as Americans? How do we do that? How do we keep going? I will pay you adequately later on, you clappers. Thank you very, very much. The path that Heschel and King were taking was the path that helps us to discover the common tasks that perhaps can draw our fragmented nation together, creating a democracy that will constantly expand to include the weakest, the poorest, and the most vulnerable among us. Heschel and King remind us that is our great and common calling as Americans. People are asking a lot today, what do we have in common? That's what we have in common. That's what the men were saying to us. We have in common the preamble to the Constitution of our nation. We, the people of the United States, are called to create a more perfect union. That's our common task. Heschel and King remind us that our great calling as a nation is not to be the number one and only military superpower in the world. Our great calling as a nation is not to be the most materially wealthy and ecologically dangerous nation and consumptionist nation in the world. That's not our great calling. Our great calling is to create a more perfect union. And in the light of the news that I have been hearing and seeing over the last few days concerning the suicide rates among our young people, it may be that we would like to consider the possibility that when we recognize our true purpose and calling as a nation, as human beings, we will actually help our children. We will give them a reason to stop killing each other and to stop killing themselves. We will give them a reason to begin to live, to create a more perfect union. That was the path of Heschel and King. That was why so many young people flocked to them. And now, my friends, we must keep going. For Heschel, for King, for our children, for our nation, for our world, we must keep going. Together, for each other. Go in peace.
Former Martin Luther King associate Vincent Harding speaking recently at the City Club Forum of Cleveland. Vincent Harding is a professor of religion and social transformation at the University of Denver. You can hear more from Dr. Harding at 9 o'clock tonight here on Minnesota Public Radio. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed in 1968 while he was in Memphis showing his support for striking garbage workers in Memphis. National Public Radio's Cheryl Corley visited Memphis recently to find out what's changed in that city since that fateful day 30 years ago.
At 7:30 in the morning, huge earthen brown trucks from the Memphis Department of Public Works roll out of the city's sanitation yards. There are separate vehicles for household garbage, recyclables, and trash like yard waste or discarded furniture. 72-year-old Taylor Rogers, now retired, says 30 years ago the job was vastly different. Workers collected garbage in tubs, carrying them on their backs, walking from backyards to the waiting trucks.
You had to carry these tubs. A lot of them had holes in them. And, you know, when you got home in the evening, you had to take off all your clothes, you know, before you could come in your house because you'd get maggots and things all over you.
Conditions were abysmal. The pay was low. Two men were crushed when one truck malfunctioned. And in 1968, the workers, nearly all black, walked off the job. The sanitation strike would become a furious struggle between the city's white mayor, the newly elected Henry Loeb, the workers, and union leaders of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Martin Luther King Jr. would be called in to help rally support.
You are demonstrating that we are all tied in a single garment of destiny, and that if one black person suffers, if one black person is down, we are all down.
If you'd be so kind to stand where you are and just listen.
In the old Lorraine Motel, where Martin Luther King Jr. stayed during his visit, tour guides now lead groups through what is the National Civil Rights Museum. The last exhibit, Room 306, is compelling even in its ordinariness. A replica of King's half-eaten last meal remains in the room. Coffee cups and saucers are strewn about, one of the two beds half-made. Outside the door, a wreath on the railing and a square in the pavement details where King was slain. Memphis minister Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles was with him.
He died helping garbage workers, the least of these. A total life of service, 39 years old. I mean, powerful, powerful.
Today, about 300 workers collect garbage for the city of Memphis. New truck designs and other efficiencies have made fewer workers necessary. Percy Farmer has been on the job since 1966.
Martin Luther King was kind of like a Moses, came out of nowhere, in a sense, I've used that word, because they was really not hearing us until Martin Luther King came to town in this march situation. And it caused a lot of heartaches, bloodshed, and a lot of things went wrong. But it worked out by the help of the good Lord.
Before Martin Luther King was killed, some city leaders from both sides of the racial divide had worked to peacefully integrate many of the city's public facilities. White attorney Lewis Donaldson, a city council member in 1968, says before the sanitation strike, anyone looking at Memphis would have thought that the racial tension was a lot less than it is today.
Now, the truth of it was that there was a lot more tension under the surface than people realized, certainly than I realized. So that perhaps actually today the racial tension is less than it was then, but it's more open.
When Martin Luther King was killed, the city's political establishment was all white. The mayor, the school superintendent, and the school board, the city's congressman. It was the old South rising on the banks of the Mississippi River. The vestiges are very public. The Confederate Park by the riverfront. In another park, the towering statue of Lieutenant General Nathan Bedford Forrest, the Confederate leader who became the first Ku Klux Klan's wizard. Memphis has added new statues to its mix, though, including a memorial to Martin Luther King Jr., and the political leaders now are black. Mayor Willie Harrington is in his second term, first elected in 1991.
I'd like to say that that fervent movement on the part of the African American community to elect one of its native sons was a strong indication that the African American community could galvanize around issues that they thought were important to their future.
Harrington won his first election with few white votes. For the first time, African Americans were the majority. In a landslide re-election, he gathered substantially more white support. And he says there are white leaders who recognize that Memphis cannot go forward unless everyone works together. In a recent survey for the Commercial Appeal, the Memphis newspaper, black and white residents said the city's racial boundaries seemed to be less rigid than they were 30 years ago. About a third said they lived in mostly black neighborhoods, another 29% lived in mostly white areas, and 35% said they lived in racially mixed communities. And while many said race relations were slowly changing for the better, the economy for black Memphians has not. They own few of the businesses in Memphis and are more likely to be unemployed than whites. Mayor Harrington says the city's biggest challenge is turning political empowerment into economic empowerment. Mayor Harrington says the city will work to provide affordable housing just as it works to develop other projects. And Reverend Billy Kiles, who stood at Martin Luther King's side 30 years ago, says the subtlety of racism still exists in Memphis, but Kiles says there has definitely been progress.
And the people who say to me or say to you that we're worse off now than we've ever been, they were not here then.
Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Memphis.
And that does it for our midday program today. Gary Ankton here, glad you could join us. Again, we're going to be rebroadcasting more of the Dr. Vincent Harding speech at 9 o'clock tonight here on Minnesota Public Radio. And tomorrow, we're going to hear from Theodore Shaw, who is Associate Director of the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, who argues that many affirmative action opponents have hijacked the Martin Luther King legacy. Programming on NPR is supported by Shandwick. Your company's reputation is an asset. Managing it is the role of Shandwick Public Relations. Again, thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you can join us tomorrow.
On the next All Things Considered, the latest on the tornado aftermath, the state's tobacco trial, and on the final days of the legislative session. All Things Considered begins at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. We have a sunny sky. It's up to 57 degrees at KNOW-FM 91.1, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Sunny to partly sunny all afternoon. High temperatures should hit the low 60s. 40% chance for some light rain tonight, and a good chance for light rain and brisk winds tomorrow in the Twin Cities.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation. 30 years ago, James Earl Ray admitted that he murdered Martin Luther King Jr. and waived his right to a trial. Within days, however, Ray repudiated that confession, and he's been fighting for a trial ever since.
The statement I am about to give to this committee is essentially the same testimony I would have given the trial court in Memphis, Tennessee in 1969 if that court would have had the fortitude to have ordered a public trial into the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King. In essence, I would have told the trial court and jury that I did not shoot Martin Luther King Jr., just as I'm not telling this committee.
Members of the King family say they now believe Ray is innocent, and they've called for a new investigation into the assassination. The life and death of Martin Luther King are the talk of the nation right after the news.